local H&R Block office today to make an appointment and get your business taxes done right.
Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story, brought to you by Frontier Floors and Window Coverings at 830 21st Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-7878 or online at frontierfloors.net.
And now, The Rest of the Story. One summer day, a couple of friends met on a New York street corner. It had been some while since Wally had seen his namesake, Walter Jennings. The young men clasped hands heartily. Jennings recalled that Wally had been studying at Yale University, Yale Medical School, in fact. How was the future physician faring, Jennings wanted to know. But Wally glanced away, as though suddenly embarrassed. He was no longer at Yale Medical, he confided. He had quit. Jennings tried unsuccessfully to conceal his astonishment. Wally went on to explain that that was why he was in New York, to explore some other kind of work, preferably in the business world. But Jennings protested Wally would have been such a wonderful doctor. He was competent, he was conscientious, and yet gentle and understanding, surely a natural in the art of bedside manner. And Wally nodded and thanked his friend. He had been so certain that medicine was the field for him that he had invested 2 years' time and an enormous effort, but now, apparently, for nothing. Jennings frowned. Wally had always been such a good student. It could not have been a matter of grades. No, not really grades, said Wally. Then beseeched Jennings why, and Wally finally, with a look of embarrassment returning to his face, related the rest of the story. That the reason this promising young physician had so abruptly abandoned medical studies was blood. Wally simply could not tolerate the sight of blood. Jennings was dumbfounded. How on earth, he wondered, had Wally made it through 2 years of med school with such an aversion? Wally explained it had not been easy. After a certain point in such a curriculum, one must emerge from the anatomy books and study firsthand. And there was frequent dissection, a live operation, and these of necessity involved the one thing Wally had come to hate more than anything in the world, blood, and just seeing it turned his stomach upside down toward the end that it became such a distraction that Wally was unable even to study effectively for examinations. So finally there had been no choice. Wally had to leave school. Well, his friend Jennings listened to all of this in amazed silence. After a long, uncomfortable pause, he clapped his friend on the shoulder. He said Wally would pull out of this. He'd have a change of scenery for a while, and eventually he'd have a change of heart. Because certainly anyone as gifted in medicine as Wally one day would return to medical school and go on to become a great doctor. It never happened. So great was his antipathy for the sight of blood that he never again considered a medical career. He established himself in business instead, and then accepted an invitation to become a collegiate athletic coach. It has been more than 100 years since Wally Camp abandoned medicine. Walter Camp, eventually to become known and revered as the father of American football. Though, and this is significant, isn't it, that those burgeoning days of that sport comprised its roughest, toughest, bloodiest era ever. Of course, that is remarkable only when you know the rest of the story.
Protecting what matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. This hour's guest is one of our regular favorites, Edward Ring, Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. We're going to talk a little bit about the overstated drought conditions in California, which have led to mismatched policy choices, what it would take to build an abundant water coalition in California, and energy security, and why California burdens its residents with taxes and shortages. Edward, welcome back to PWM.
Yeah, thank you very much, Barry. It's good to be here.
Glad to have you. You can call in or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So I'd like to start right off the bat here with a study that you guys published in January called the Statistical Review of the United States Drought Monitor. And in my layman's takeaway from this report is that much of our water policy has been based on faulty data in California, similar to the misinformation that was fed to us by the climate change people at the United Nations for so many decades. So if you could take some time to unpack this report, and so let's start with who is or what is the U.S. Drought Monitor, and how do they impact our water policy from a high level? And then I'll just let you roll into what your conclusions were, what you found, okay?
Yeah, you bet. The U.S. Drought Monitor is kind of a consortium. It's a many-headed hydra. There's a collection of water hydrology, meteorological experts scattered around the country. They're mostly federally funded, and they've collaborated ever since around 2000 to produce a report that's updated once a week that reports drought conditions everywhere in the country. And the report had California for, I think, the entire 25 years. There wasn't a single weekly report that didn't have at least some portion of the state in some level of drought. They have, you know, severe drought, exceptional drought, moderate drought, abnormally dry, and then they have, you know, a non-drought condition where the map isn't colored in some shade of yellow, cascading all the way to, you know, dark purple, which would be an extraordinary drought. And you'd see some portion of California shaded with some level of drought everywhere for the last 25 years. And it's interesting that in January of this year, for the first time, they didn't have any of California shaded in drought. But we looked at their report over the quarter century that they've been operating, and we believe, because we talked with the people that do this study, and it wasn't clear that they really had they definitely don't have transparency in how they arrive at their conclusions, and it wasn't clear to us talking with them that they really had a collective understanding internally of how they arrived to their conclusions. We studied their methods as well as we possibly could, and what we were able to infer from what we observed from all of their data and their what methods that they disclosed is that they're representing drought conditions in California and throughout the country at a level twice as severe as in the previous century, in the 20th century. So operating on that assumption, we went ahead and looked at raw station data across California for as far back as it goes, and we dumped, hundreds of thousands of data points into a spreadsheet, and we analyzed the rainfall, the snowpack, the humidity, the temperature, and a couple other variables, vapor pressure deficit. And what we were able to observe from looking at quarter centuries, because you really don't have a lot of station data past 1925. So we looked at the second, third, and fourth 25-year quarters of the 1900s, the 20th century, and then we looked at the same data for the first 25 years of this century. So we had four blocks of quarter century results, and we couldn't find any measurable decline in rainfall. We couldn't find any statistically significant increase in temperature or decrease in humidity. There was a decline in the snowpack, although when we went back even further, because you can get some pretty interesting data based on tree rings, we found that snowfall itself is showing about a 9% decline in the snowpack in California in this quarter century. But if you look way back with tree ring data, it's not clear that that's a trend or just, there are drought conditions that have existed in California that have lasted centuries, if you go back thousands of years looking at tree ring data. So to make a long story short, we weren't able to corroborate the idea that's put forth by the U.S. Drought Monitor that we are in an extraordinary drought. Obviously, we need to be able to manage the situation if more of our water is coming from rain and we're not getting to save some of it up on the top of the Sierra Nevada mountains for summer. That requires some adaptation. But in terms of, for example, suggesting that our forests are burning because of higher temperatures and less rain is simply false. The data that we were able to look at, and we looked at a lot of it, I think we looked at more of it than they've probably looked at for the previous century, yeah. Just doesn't suggest that we're in a period of extraordinary drought.
So again, how has this impacted policymakers' decision-making over the last 25 years or even the last 10 years? I mean, again, if they're...
It's been very influential.
Yeah.
When they see those, shades of red smearing over the map of the state of California, that influences water agencies. It influences the state legislature. It influences the state water board, It's something that environmental groups will rely on. It's considered a very credible source of information on the state of California's hydrology, and that's another thing. The Drought Monitor doesn't have any connection to how much water we've actually got stored. So, for example, if we've had three wet years, which we have, and our storage is relatively full, and it ought to be. Even more full, we should have even more water stored, but that's a policy decision. We're not going to go into a so-called hydrological drought where we don't have enough water to irrigate our crops or transport to our cities. Even if we had a very dry year, even if it never rained again in this particular season, we would have plenty of water. And the Drought Monitor doesn't measure that. It only looks at weather conditions.
So really, it's caused our policymakers to create even more man-made disasters in the state. I mean, you think about how it impacts agriculture. They shut the water off to the Central Valley based on this kind of stuff, right?
Well, they do, and there's a lot of consequences of that. If you we could go on, we could talk the whole hour about the negative consequences of shutting off water to the farmers. A lot of that water, they ought to be releasing that water when they have storms, and just recharging the aquifers would be a major step forward. If you got a little bit more water into those, you could take some out. You could be still recharging the aquifers while also relying on it for some of your water. That sort of option is just taken away when they stop shipping water south.
Yeah. So shifting gears, and we'll just shift right into this. I mean, you worked with Steve Hilton, gubernatorial candidate, who was here just a few days ago and spoke to a group of people here. He had a good crowd. And you helped him with creating a program. This goes back into August, where it's called Achieving Water Abundance, a new approach based on positive common sense ideas. So this is basically Steve's idea of getting some sanity to our water policy in California. What were the high-level conclusions of this report that you did?
Well, I like the way Steve thinks. I have an insight into how he thinks about policy because I did work with him on 10 policy papers, including water and including one on energy. And, you know, the fundamental philosophy is you can't ration your way to abundance. You can't conserve your way to abundance. You take away all of the resilience. If, you know, even if you're successful through conservation in balancing the budget so that there's enough water supply to meet water demand, the problem with that approach is if anything happens to the whole system, you end up with a very serious crisis. You need water abundance because if something happens, there's a earthquake that liquefies levees in the delta. That's the classic disaster scenario. Or there's a cyber attack and the Tehachapi pumps, you know, throw a couple of pistons and everything shuts down for a couple of years. You know, you can pick your disaster. But if we have one, all of a sudden, there's no resilience in the system. You need to have a water supply that comes from the, you know, and it's a cliche, but all of the above strategy, especially for water. You need everything from seawater desalination to more surface storage, more underground storage, more runoff capture, more wastewater recycling. You need everything, and you need to create surplus water. There's even a lot of evidence that if we just had more water in our cities, we would mitigate the heat island effect, and we would actually have less required irrigation because we would keep the temperature down. You know, there's all kinds of interesting, very contrary views to the way state policy is designed today. But, you know, what Steve's trying to get at, and I agree completely, is that We can't conserve our way to abundance. And they talk about, Democrats have picked up on the abundance theme. You know, this is something we've all been talking about for a very long time. All of a sudden, the abundance, the Democrats grabbed it, and that quickly morphed into affordability. But you just can't achieve those things through rationing and through top-down centralized solutions. You have to have a diverse sources of water, and you have to deregulate the permitting environment so that it's not at a prohibitive cost to invest in and build all of these water supply assets that we need.
Well, and the underlying issue here, and I'm looking at the key points of this report, and folks, you can get all of Edward's work, find it all on the California Policy Center website under the Water tab or Energy tab. He's prolific in this stuff. But, you know, you basically point out that we got, you know, a water infrastructure that was built for 20 million people, and now we got 40 million people in the state. And this is unsustainable, and we're wasting money on other things that are not as important. I mean, that's the bottom line that you know, voters should be thinking about when they go to the polls in June and then, of course, in November. So, this and one of the things that you just wrote a few articles on is desalinization. So I'd like you to take the rest of this segment, which is about 3 or 4 minutes, to talk a little bit about why large-scale desalinization should be in California, and what would that take, and who's against it again? This is common sense stuff. Why is it not happening?
Well, there's three arguments: environmental, and then the financial cost to build it, and the energy cost. And each of those you can debunk pretty fast. I mean, in 3 minutes, I can tick through as quickly as possible. The environmental arguments are just ridiculously overblown. You just spent, about an hour talking about the impact of floating offshore wind, where you have thousands of these massive turbines with cables going down to the sea bottom 4,000 feet down and high voltage cables going 20 miles to shore and basically industrializing the coast to receive all this stuff and to stage all of this construction. And you compare that to a desalination plant that they rejected in Huntington Beach that was going to sit on
acres. Edward, I've got a call coming in. Let's hold your thought. Let's take this call.
Please.
Thanks for calling Protecting What Matters. What's your question for Edward?
Couple concepts that I wanted to see if I was how close to the truth I was.
You got a couple minutes here, so make it quick concepts.
We stopped dredging the Sacramento River a while back, and that we knew that was kind of a problem, but we refused to go back and redredge it, and how that affects our abilities in the state is kind of an intentional limitation we gave ourselves. And the other one is, I'm curious, when I hear the governor say Delta smelt, I think what he's talking about is we have so many people polluting the San Francisco Bay that we have to flush it out all the time or else it'll become a septic tank. Are either of those concepts close?
Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Edward, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm glad he brought up both of those points because there's, starting with the Bay, there's, I think, 37 seawater desalination plants surrounding the Bay and in the estuary portions of the Delta, and they put out 400,000 acre-feet of effluent, inadequately treated sewage that still is very nitrogen-rich, and that causes algae blooms, and then the algae dies and creates dead zones. And, yes, they have to flush more water through the Bay instead of cleaning up those water treatment plants to a higher level of treatment. That's number one. The caller is also, I believe, absolutely correct about dredging. If we were to, we could talk an hour about dredging, but if you got the channels in the Southern Delta, especially back to their historical depths, you would increase the water volume, which means you could pump without draining the water so that Delta farmers can't irrigate anymore. You would also make it so you could operate the pumps longer before you would be pulling salt water in from the ocean. You would also make it possible to get more water during flood events safely out of the Delta, so you could save more water in the reservoirs. You wouldn't have to reserve space for quick runoff. So there's more. I mean, salmon like the deeper channels. So dredging is essential. Cleaning up the water treatment plants is also essential.
So back to these, and again, what you're talking about here is, again, that all of the above, policy that we need to be doing a lot more, and again, back to desalinization. What are the pros? What are the cons? Real quickly, we got about another minute left in this segment.
Well, the environmental issues are, I think, negligible by comparison to other things out there. We have the California Current to take the brine and disperse it. We can get the residual chemicals from filtration out of the brine before it's released. The costs aren't as high as the costs are coming down. The energy costs as well are much lower than people say. I can hear the music in the background.
Yeah.
I can give you the numbers, but we'll have to save it for later.
Let's do it on the other side of the break, and then we'll talk about energy when we return with Edward Ring. Edward, I'm going to put you on hold for 2 minutes. Stand by, everybody.
Ace Auto Care in Atascadero, the best price and service on brakes, tires, smog checks, oil changes, and more. Ace Auto Care. All your vehicle needs, everything you want.
Fox News, I'm Tom Rigotti. Fighting rages on in the Middle East following U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran. Speaking during his meeting with President Trump at the White House today, Irish Prime Minister Micheál Martin says he hopes there will be a diplomatic solution.
To work to see, can we bring peace, a different regime to Iran where Iranians can live in peace again and the people in the Middle East can live in peace.
Airports are seeing delays and staffing issues due to the partial government shutdown. Fox Business Network's Madison Allworth reports from Newark Liberty International Airport.
Officers missed their first full paycheck on Friday, and as a result, the call-out rate for TSA officers was 10.19% on Sunday. That's compared to the normal 2% before the shutdown.
Democrats say they won't approve any Homeland Security funding without changes to ICE and CBP. America's listening to Fox News.
CNC Tree Service, locally owned by Randall and Shannon Clegg for 38 years. Tree removal, trimming, cabling, corrective pruning, stump grinding, brush and road clearance. They have the equipment for any residential or commercial job. If you want instant shade with mature trees, they have the only spade truck in the area to plant or move your large trees. CNC has moved oaks, manzanita, olives, palms, pepper, and various others. Licensed and insured, member of the International Society of Arboriculture. Call 805-434-0914.
Wow. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Edward Ring, Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. Call in or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Let's wrap up on the desalinization here, Edward. I mean, because, you know, we live in a state that spends money like a drunken sailor, but they're not, but here's a technology and an opportunity that they just shut their eyes to here. What's the story?
Well, you know, to try to get through this pretty quickly, to start with, you have to think big when you talk about desalination, because it's something that's in the world, 40 million acre feet a year of fresh water is being pulled out of the world's oceans. They're doing it everywhere. They could easily do it here. We have ideal conditions. We have a quick drop-off on the continental shelf. We have a very strong current. Everything that you need in terms of minimizing the environmental impact is present here in California. It's an ideal place. Look at how you could finance this, for example, by offsetting water from the Colorado River. We import 800,000 acre-feet into California's coastal cities in Southern California through the Colorado Aqueduct. There's a lot more that goes to farming in the Imperial Valley, but let's just talk about that 800,000 acre-feet. If you wanted to replace that with desalinated water, it would cost about $14 billion to build the plants. Now, that sounds like a lot, but if you finance that at 4% interest on a 20-year bond, it actually comes out to about $900 per acre foot. Now, we're buying water from the Metropolitan Water District of Los Angeles in Southern California at $1,500 an acre foot, and that price is going to double in the next 10 years as they start investing in getting PFAS out of the water and so forth, which you don't have with desalinated water. You could give that water back to Arizona and Nevada, and they would pay the financing costs because that's cheap water for the cities of Las Vegas and Phoenix. That means all you'd have to pay is the energy and operating costs in Southern California for that 800,000 feet of water. Now, at 8 cents a kilowatt hour, that's $300 an acre foot, which is not very much when you're spending on a retail basis $2,500 per acre foot, on a wholesale basis $1,500 per acre foot, and the numbers are going up. When you talk about the energy, by the way, you know, it's 3,500 kilowatt hours per acre foot. To put that in perspective, the Diablo Canyon power plant, which puts out 2 gigawatts, would be able to desalinate 5 million acre-feet a year. All you do is leave Diablo Canyon open, and you have enough electricity to desalinate 5 million acre-feet. I could give you other examples. It takes the same amount of energy to pump the water over the Tehachapi's that it would take to desalinate the water. So energy is not an issue either.
We got a caller here. What's your question for Edward?
Well, I spent a lot of time up in the Delta, and I know that they're trying to do all these environmental things, but a proposal was made, 10, 15 years ago. It's a lot easier to desalinate brackish water as opposed to seawater. And right there at the right near the Antioch area where the Sacramento River comes into the bay, it's brackish water. It's half salt water and half clean water. And you could easily build a desalination plant on one of the islands out there that the state owns already. And on another island, you put a big, huge solar plant. There's tons of wind around there, and you got wind, so that makes everybody happy because you're saving the smelt, you're desalinating the bad water, you're using solar and using air, and everybody's happy. So what's your thoughts on that?
Thanks for your call.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. Edward, what do you think?
Well, I think that brackish water desalination has a lot of potential as well, and there are situations where you can get it from the ground, or you can get it from groundwater that's replenished really fast. There's a company in down in the Mojave Desert area, Cadiz, that's working on some ideas that can harvest brackish water. And you're right, it costs, depending on how brackish it is, it's about half as much energy and about half as much operating costs. The thing about taking it out of the Delta, that's a good idea, and Antioch's already doing it on a small scale, the city of Antioch. But why not just go a little further upstream and take fresh water out and pump it into the aqueduct? I think one of the things with the Delta that if we could get rid of some of the issues that dredging would solve and that fixing our wastewater treatment plants would solve, and then we had, and there's examples out of what could be done. It's not just the tunnel. There are other options that would cost less. If we could safely take more fresh water out of the Delta during winter storms, you're looking at millions of acre feet of fresh water that could be harvested without having to go a little further into the estuary and desalinate brackish water. So it does have a utility, or the city of Antioch wouldn't be doing it. But I think that's, you know, part of a portfolio, and maybe just getting that fresh water further upstream, if we could just figure out how to do that during our big storms in a safe manner, and there are ways to do that, might be more cost effective.
All right. We're going to shift gears to energy here now, and you wrote it up, but we'll bring water into the kind of the close here. You wrote an article back in January where stating that the common denominators of prosperity in California is energy and water, our energy and water. And some of us are still interested in prosperity and economic development in this state, at least, you know, a portion of us. Why do you say that these are the two things that we really need to harness in a proper way to move the state forward again?
Well, it makes everything else easier. I mean, the argument with energy is pretty cut and dry, because all fuel is, it's used in whatever you've got, whether it's a tractor in the fields or shipping on land, sea, and air. All of our shipping requires energy. Every building, everything we do requires energy. So if you have inexpensive energy, that cost as a percentage of whatever it is you're producing or shipping or consuming goes down. So, you know, it's pretty obvious, I think, that we need more energy. Water, it's a direct influence, perhaps in several obvious ways, maybe not pervading the entire economy, but certainly our farm economy, any water-intensive manufacturing. Data centers need water now, although I think they can recycle the water. They just have to invest a little bit more to have that capacity. But water as well is something that will roll into the cost of everything else. So, and there's also a quality of life element to prosperity. Do we really want to have these messy heat island xeriscapes, you know, with plastic, with rocks on top, and a couple of cactus growing in every front yard in Los Angeles?
Kind of like Phoenix, huh?
Well, and we're not Phoenix.
That's right.
We can stick a straw in the ocean and have all the water we want. And we have a lot of rain. We have a tremendous, 200 million acre feet of water in an average year fall into California watersheds. We just have to manage it. So, I'm sticking to that story. I believe water and energy are fundamental. Obviously, there's other things that are fundamental. We have to deregulate our whole economy to make it possible, for example, for private developers to be able to build an affordable house and still make a profit without subsidies. And to do that, we have to deregulate land development, and we have to invest again in water and energy infrastructure so that that's in place, so it's possible to build new homes. There's plenty of room in California. We could use up a small, tiny fraction of that and have all the room for new homes we'd ever want.
Yeah, but that's a big, huge problem for us. We have another. You are very popular today, Edward. So we got another caller. And caller, there was a lot of background noise, so please mute your background. So we're going to try it again.
Is it any better?
It is now. Thank you very much.
Hey, not a problem.
In answer to your question,
you just answered, do I want cactus and rocks in everybody's front yard? Yes, as a matter of fact, and especially in the freeway medians. I looked at it in San Luis Obispo. They're probably spending how many millions of dollars to redo all the little islands in the freeway? What's wrong with a few rocks and a nice sculpture?
Well, is that a question or just a comment?
Both.
All right. What do you think?
I'm serious. No. I'm very serious.
Well, you're right. Edward, what do you think? Thanks for your call.
Well, you know, it comes back to how much does it cost to do all this stuff. If we had a little bit less, I think, how do you put this? You kind of stumped me a little bit there, because I agree with the concept that we want to be efficient with how we use our resources, but it comes back to if we had less regulation, less redesigns, less bureaucracy, and we just went out there and did some of this stuff, it wouldn't be at a prohibitive cost. And then the question is, well, what kind of a barrier do you want in between your northbound and southbound lanes? I think Oleander will probably stop a car better than a concrete statue.
Yeah, my Oleanders do, that's for sure.
It might be a little easier on the driver.
Yeah.
But, and I think aesthetics matter. I don't think we should strip everything down to the bone in order to save a little money. We need to use the money more efficiently. Things that cost $1 million could probably be constructed for $100,000 in some cases if we weren't so bureaucratic about how we get things done. So I would start there before I would, put concrete wherever we might be able to have landscaping.
When you can't do the development for that inexpensive when you have to hire so many consultants to consult on the project. I mean, that's
exactly right. It's become really hard to just get out the equipment, get the guys that do real work, and just send them out and tell them to go to work. You have to have millions of rounds of consultations and hearings and process, and everybody's got to get involved. And that doubles, triples, or more the
yep.
cost of things. And so fix that, and then we'll see if it's still worth, paving over our medians.
So, days before we went into Iran, you wrote an article, again, called The Delusions of Davos and Dubai versus Realistic Pathways to Global Energy. So it was an interesting article, and I know you were reviewing what happened at the COP28 summit in Dubai. What were the high-level points, and what has changed in your mind now that we're dealing with Iran as we have in the last few weeks? How does that change the worldwide energy picture, which really impacts California because we get so much of our oil from overseas in California?
Yeah, we do. I mean, the cost per gallon before the war was based on about low 60s per barrel. And that translates to $1.50. In other words, in your price at the pump, $1.50 of that $4 or $5 or $6 per gallon is the crude oil. Mm-hmm. So if the crude oil goes to 100, let's say it goes to 120, that's $3 of whatever you're paying at the pump instead of $1.50. Those costs are passed through. So, that does affect us, obviously. It affects everyone on Earth. When you have a spike in the price of crude oil, it affects everyone on Earth. What was in that article, one of the main points of that whole thing, and I just go to, the Statistical Review of Global Energy, which is a very reliable, authoritative source that is renewed, updated once a year. We've been using about 80% fossil fuel to power the planet's economy for the last several decades. It hasn't moved.
Mm-hmm.
Renewables, so-called renewables, have increased in terms of their absolute production, but the entire consumption worldwide has been increasing at the same pace. So they continue to only represent about 20%. Oil, coal, natural gas are 80%, and that's true in America. That's true in China. A little bit more coal in the mix, but it's 80%. It's 80-20. It's 80-20 in California. We're 50% petroleum, 30% natural gas, and 20% everything else. That's roughly the same as the U.S., and again, and worldwide, that's roughly the same, a little more role for coal. So the point of the article was, they talk about doubling nuclear. Well, if nuclear is only 4% of total global energy, you can double it all you like. The other point, the same goes for hydroelectric. And nobody, hydroelectric, you can't scale that. You might be able to double it. Nuclear, you might be able to triple or quadruple. But you're still looking at a big challenge, which is that for everybody on Earth to use half as much energy as Americans do per capita, you have to double the energy production in the planet. And you're not going to get there without coal, oil, and gas, not for a long time. So we have to accept that. And as a state, we ought to be setting an example of how to use, for example, natural gas in a super efficient way, because they're not going to stop using it in the rest of the world. That's absolutely not going to happen.
Well, and the use of of natural gas worldwide has spiked, and that's had a really good effect on environmental problems, isn't it?
Well, you know, you can look at it two ways. You can say, what's the carbon intensity of natural gas versus coal? And it's a lower carbon intensity with natural gas, and people who worry about CO2 applaud that fact. But there's other benefits to natural gas, which is it's just a cleaner fuel. It's a lot easier to scrub all the genuine pollutants out of natural gas emissions compared to coal emissions. So whether or not you're concerned about atmospheric CO2, natural gas is a cleaner fuel.
Yeah. Switching to gasoline prices in California, you know, Governor Newsom is being pilloried in the press for saying that the claims that California has lower taxes than Texas and Florida. He doesn't, and that their systems are more regressive tax systems, which hurts the middle and lower class. What he fails to point out, or and it should be pointed out, is that our high gas taxes, as well as where our prices are going at the moment, are even more hurtful to the middle class. So, I mean, you've long been predicting California is going to be having gas lines and $8 a gallon gas, at least since you've been on the show here. I mean, are you still seeing that? I mean, what's our future look like here in California from gasoline, from a gasoline price perspective?
Well, you know, it was that professor down at USC, I think his last name is Mishka, who came out with a well-publicized study predicting $8 a gallon gasoline. There's two ways that you're going to get gas lines and prices that high. One is if something, they're shutting down our refineries, and they're making up for that by importing refined gasoline. Now, if they drive our refineries out of the state faster than they can bulk up to import refined gasoline from elsewhere, then you're going to have a severe shortage, and you're going to have gas lines and $8 gas. Now, is that going to happen is kind of up to the state legislature and the California Air Resources Board and some of the people that are running the state. I believe Chevron just sent a letter to the Sacramento saying, if you go through with some of these next rounds of carbon credit auction required payments, we're leaving. So if that happens faster than they can import refined gasoline, you're going to have the lines, you're going to have the super high prices. And the problem with importing the refined gasoline, that will add about 50 cents to the price of a gallon of oil. Now, right now, that's still only about 5% of our gasoline that we have to import based on the two refinery closures we've just seen. We're about 5% short in our refinery capacity. You import gasoline that costs 50% more because you have to ship refined gasoline from overseas instead of making it here, but it's only 5% of the mix. That won't translate into a 50% bump. But if it gets really bad because we lose a couple more refineries and we're not able to even bring it in because we don't have the capacity in our ports and our, you know, it's not the same facilities to process crude oil that it is to process refined gasoline. So everything has to be built out. It takes time. So that could be one source. The other one, of course, is the war. You know, nobody was sure if and when there was going to be a war. But when you have the Strait of Hormuz closed up, obviously, that's going to cause these price spikes as well. If we didn't have the war, and if they quit driving our refineries out of state, we probably could prevent the gasoline prices from going much higher. And, of course, they're already way too high compared to other states.
What about the Trump administration's efforts to use the Defense Production Act to restart California oil operations off of Santa Barbara? I mean, that's not going to really help either, even if it happens, because we don't have the refining capacity, right?
Well, the crude oil imports and the refinery capacity are related. I mean, we produce about 300,000 barrels a day in-state crude oil. And you have the Santa Barbara Channel, the Sable wells, with 50,000. That's going to bump our crude oil supply by 16%. But you're right, Barry, that's not going to make up for the fact that we're in a pinch in terms of refinery capacity. Is our gasoline consumption dropping enough right now to make up for that 4 to 5% shortfall between supply and demand right now, refinery capacity and gasoline demand? I don't know. I mean, that's where prices lower demand, and then you get your equilibrium back.
Well, we'll see. Edward, hang on. We got one more segment. Folks, we will return with Edward Ring. We'll wrap up with our conversation about energy and water and take any of your questions. I'm really happy everybody's so engaged with today's topics. So stand by.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL is brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
I'm Stuart Varney, and this is the Fox Business Report.
The major averages ending higher for a second day, but the Dow lost steam heading into the closing bell as investors monitor developments in the Middle East and as oil prices continue to spike. Brent crude, the international benchmark, hovered at around $103 a barrel, while U.S. crude is around $95 a barrel. Tech and energy were among the best performers among the S&P 500 sectors, while healthcare and consumer staples lagged. In the meantime, the Fed kicking off its two-day policy meeting today. Shares of Honeywell fell 2% after the industrial giant said that the conflict in the Middle East could impact its first quarter revenue. The Dow winners, Goldman Sachs, IBM, and Caterpillar. The Dow decliners, Johnson & Johnson, Amgen, and Salesforce. The Dow rising 47 points, the Nasdaq higher by 105, S&P 500 up 17. That's your Fox Business Report. I'm Hillary Barsky, invested in you.
Live it. That's why more Americans are choosing gold. Noble Gold has helped thousands protect their future with real physical gold. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com to get your free wealth protection kit. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
At Peak Painting, we get it. Hiring contractors can be frustrating. Missed calls, no callbacks, endless waiting for even a price. We do things different. You can book your quote right on the spot. And to top that off, you will have a detailed quote and price before we leave. Painting is easier with Peak.
Hi, I'm Seth Peak.
And I'm Ryan Peak.
And we're the Peak Brothers. From cabinet painting to interior painting.
Exterior painting, both residential and commercial.
We're your go-to family-owned and operated painting company serving all of Slo County. We look forward to working with you. To learn more and book your appointment, visit Peak Painting at peekpainting.com.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Edward Ring, Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. Call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Next week's show is going to feature Karen Talon from the Groves on 41. We're going to call it Olive Education Day on a PWM, and I'm sorry for saying I'm not sure what's wrong with my brain, but Olive Education Day on Protecting What Matters. We will be talking about all the things you can eat olive oil on and how you can prepare foods with it. It's going to be a great show. And then for the 1 o'clock hour, we're going to have Joel Peterson, CEO of the Paso Robles Wine Country Alliance. Edward, we got one more topic I wanted you to kind of touch on primarily, and then I want to know what you're looking at over the next few months that are going to be things that our audience should be listening to about, but issues. But you wrote an article about why data centers will create electricity abundance. There's been a lot of buzz that these data centers that are being built for AI are going to hurt particularly rural communities because there's going to be such a energy suck that it's going to raise prices dramatically. You have a contrary view on this a bit, and you see it as an opportunity.
Well, first of all, I think there's going to be examples of exactly what you described. So while I think that it's important to point out the upside, because there is some upside to all of this, that doesn't mean we're not going to have examples where exactly what you just described is happening and there's, you know, all of a sudden electricity shortages. These data centers are migrating to places with the cheapest electricity, and obviously if they have a deregulated environment and cheap electricity and they can get an interconnection to the grid right away, whereas, you know, here in California it would take them forever, they're going to go there, they're going to get hooked up to the grid, and all of a sudden there's going to be electricity shortages. And that's a scenario that I'm not trying to deny. What I do think is an opportunity, though, is in states like California, where they want to have these data centers, and they're building some huge data centers in the Imperial Valley right now, and there's sites all over California, they have to wait too long to get a utility interconnection, and they have to wait too long for all of the permits that they're going to need if they want to consume a lot of electricity. So what they're doing instead is putting on-site reactors at their data centers. And there's two things here. That, first of all, they have more money than most private investors have ever had. These guys don't have to worry about their budget. They can spend whatever it takes to build electricity generators. The other thing is they're not accustomed to the decade-scale timelines that utility bureaucrats and state bureaucrats are comfortable with. These are guys that are used to product launches where they go from, you know, start to launching a product in 12 to 18 months. So they have an expectation of making rapid progress. And finally, these are innovators. So these are people that are going to use every kind of energy production, energy generation technology, whether it's conventional and established or emerging and experimental, and they're going to pour money into it. They're going to stimulate innovation in energy production that we really haven't seen up till now, because they have all this money, they have all of this technological expertise, and they have this culture of urgency. You know, so they're going to do things like enhanced geothermal, which is a kind of non-controversial way to generate energy that's very, very promising. It's a huge wild card. And my theory is we could see situations where they generate so much energy that they have surplus energy, so that when they get their interconnection to the grid, they're actually selling cheap power into the grid instead of consuming power.
So these on-site nuclear reactors, they're like the ones that go onto ships, right? Is that kind of size?
And there's a tremendous amount of innovation going on with small, they call them small modular reactors or SMRs. There's a lot of different types of SMR technology. The shipboard ones, I think, are really small-scale versions of your typical fission reactors, but they have a lot of ways to, you know, they're almost like batteries. They're the size of a shipping container. They put out 30 to 50 megawatts, and after, you know, 30 or 40 years, they just swap them out. They last that long. There's what they call radioisotope thermal generators, which are pebble bed reactors, which don't even require a transfer fluid. There's all kinds of technologies emerging with nuclear, so that's another one. And you want to talk about all of the above. They're also investing in natural gas, conventional natural gas power generation to the tune of 50, 60. There's 250 gigawatts of capacity nationwide just in natural gas power plant construction, and about a third of that's for data centers. That's an astonishing amount of power. They're using anything and everything they can find to make sure that we have more energy than we need, not less.
So this could be a good thing in the hopefully not too distant future. As you conjure up new articles for the next few months, are you seeing any interesting new trends that people should be watching out for, and preview what you're going to be having on your website at the Cal Policy Center?
Well, you know, Barry, conjuring is not the word I would have chosen. You know, the next couple of weeks I've got three teed up. There's We're going to talk about offshore, floating offshore wind. We're going to talk about dredging in the Delta. We're going to talk about large-scale desalination. Those are three things I'm looking at very carefully the last few weeks.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much again for being on the show with us today, folks. Please follow Edward at the California Policy Center. I think that's californiapolicycenter.org. And he's a great writer, and you'll learn a whole lot. Edward, thank you so much for being with us. And folks, thanks for being with us today. We'll see you next week with our next Protecting What Matters.
Join us next Tuesday for Protect What Matters the Most with Barry Fisher. Send your questions and show topic ideas to barry@blazinbear.com. AM 1230 KPRL, 99.3 FM, KPRL.com, Paso Robles, Atascadero, Templeton.
It's